It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Come, ye thankful people, come. It's Thanksgiving 2016, and we have so much to be thankful for. Let's begin by just celebrating through this old, beautiful hymn.
Thank you.
a great way to start our Thanksgiving celebration. It is Thanksgiving 2016. Sandy Rios with you. Have we something to be grateful for today? I was listening to that hymn, I'm thinking about our founding fathers. I'm thinking about that first Thanksgiving in Massachusetts. I'm thinking about the pilgrims as they landed after that terrible trip on the Plymouth shores and formed the Mayflower Compact, one of the earliest. I think about their faith in God and how they trusted him and how he blessed in ways they could not even imagine. And I think that probably most people listening to me feel a renewed hope that somehow we might actually reclaim God's blessing on this country, that God maybe has heard our cry and stayed his hand of judgment and instead given us discipline, which we take gladly, which we will learn from, and which we will use as a correcting tool in our own lives as we go about our business and do our work and in our churches as we truly become salt and light in this country. I'm just thinking, you know, this is the day when, these are the days this week when we think about what we are grateful for. And if I were to open the phone lines, there would be so many things. I expressed to you just recently after the election the things that struck me immediately that I personally am so grateful for. And some of you are in this category, Americans who were being killed by high healthcare premiums and unbelievable deductibles, who are sick and in need of care but can't even afford it. I think of all those soldiers, some of you serving in bases around the country, listen to me every day. I think of your deployments and the danger of it and the uncertainty of your commander-in-chief, the lack of trust in the Pentagon officials, and how maybe there's hope that the rules of engagement will be changed and the military will be stopped being used as some sort of a tool to for social experimentation, that religious freedoms will be restored in the American military. I think of border ranchers, those of you down, certainly, mainly on the border, who have had an absolute invasion of your property, and often by people who are criminals, but sometimes just people who are desperate, but in their process of trying to get across to, for whatever thing that drives them, committing crimes and, you know, against you and your neighbors, even some of you killed, and you haven't had any protection from your government. And I think about you, and I'm grateful. I think of coal miners listening, who really have had been devastated this last 8 years. Their coal mines shut down and reduced, and your jobs lost, and generations of your way of life threatened, desperate, depressed, and sad. And I think of the FBI agents who stuck their lives and their fortunes and their careers on the line to investigate a corrupt Hillary Clinton foundation and found all kinds of things, and yet the Justice Department, which is corrupt, chose not to pursue it. And now these agents, you know, their life hung in the balance, their future, depending on which way the election went. And so I find myself thankful for them that they had courage and thankful that God has heard those of them that prayed, has heard their prayers. And I could go on and on. Elections, you know, do have consequences, and we are certainly grateful for that. I'm grateful. Shall I change the topic a little bit? I'm grateful that the Cubs won the World Series. That was personally very fun. I know you Cleveland Indians fans are not thankful for that, but this was a huge deal, and this is the year it happened. And then if we were to talk about personal things, I have a lot of things that I'm really grateful for this year. Maybe some I haven't spoken of at the mic, but I will say I want to thank God for my loving husband, who loves me and encourages me and rebukes me when I need it. And he supports the mission that God has called me to. Doesn't mind the early morning hours, is very patient with the tensions, and sometimes I'm not the most pleasant person to be around because I'm worried about things, and he bears it all and encourages me and believes that God has called me, and it's one of the reasons I can do what I do. I thank God for him. I'm thankful for my son. Something has happened. I'm not sure I've spoken of this, but he's been accepted to St. Andrews in Scotland to get his PhD in biblical studies. And he's taking his wife and three small children. It's a huge adventure, very expensive one, I might add. But they are embarking on a different world. I'm sure that in my lifetime, I will not see the ways that God will use my son. But my son has a passion for the Lord that is just, I am so grateful. I was a single mother. It could have been so different. And so I am grateful to God for that. I'm also grateful that my son and his wife are bringing their three little ones and coming to spend Christmas with us. How good does that get? How much better does it get than that? So I have so much to be grateful for. And that reminds me of something that someone shared with me. I don't know who to attribute this to, but here's a kind of a cute story. A 10-year-old girl was asked by another classmate, what is it like to be a Christian? And the 10-year-old girl replied, well, it's like being a pumpkin. God picks you up from the patch, brings you in, and washes all the dirt off you. Then he cuts open the top and scoops out all the yucky stuff. He removes the seeds of doubt, hate, greed, etc., and then he carves you a new smiling face and puts his light inside of you to shine for all the world to see. Is that not sweet? So as you're carving your pumpkins for Thanksgiving or you're cleaning them out to make pumpkin pie, remember that analogy. It really is quite a beautiful one. Sometimes children speak truth to us in ways the adults don't think about. Okay, and I'm going to close with some practical tips this segment. This is really cool. I read this. I love HGTV magazine. It's my guilty pleasure. I enjoy it so much. And they have, for those of you that are cooking your turkey, if it's not too late, here's a couple of tips. It takes a long time to defrost it, so don't forget to do that. And of course, you need about a pound and a half or a pound per person in order that you have enough for seconds, and you know you want seconds. And so they say that turkeys that are smaller than 12 pounds have less meat on the bone. So no matter how many people you want, at least a turkey about 12 pounds. You also want it, according to HGTV magazine, you don't want to use a pop-up thermometer because those don't work properly. They suggest you invest in a digital food thermometer for the most accurate food reading, and then you jab it where the drumstick meets the thigh, and that's how you get the proper temperature. And then after you cook it, now this really does apply, you know, if we're too far down the street for you to do those other things. After you cook it, it needs a good long rest. If you slice your bird right out of the oven, all the juices will stream out, leaving the meat dry. So give your turkey a 20 to 30 minute timeout before carving it, which will allow the juices to redistribute. Don't worry about getting cold, because a whole turkey, can stay warm for up to an hour. So there you go, all you turkey lovers. How often do you get cooking tips from me? Not very often. I guess I should be grateful this Thanksgiving that I don't have to cook very often. I love to cook holiday meals. I used to cook all the time, of course. I cooked all the time for my children and family, but my circumstances and work life don't require that of me, so I don't cook very much anymore. But holidays are such a wonderful time to lovingly prepare the foods that your loved ones enjoy and your friends. There's just nothing like it. And it seems to me that in our country, we have lost the art of hospitality, the art of, which it really means bringing people into your home and making them part of your home, not displaying your great cooking acumen, although that's nice too, or your lovely decorated home, not that so much, as bringing them in and sharing your life. And that's what hospitality is all about. And of course, hospitality is a big deal in Scripture, that we bring people into our homes and share our lives with them. And this is a great day to sit around the table and to, you know, hold hands and pray and thank God in detail. The turkey will wait for all of the wonderful things He's done for us, for you personally, for this nation, for our country, and also to remember the rich heritage that we have inherited. And so coming up next, Bill Federer, who is one of my favorite historians, will take us back in time and talk a little about that first Thanksgiving and all the things that we have to be grateful for in our history. So, all right, so stay tuned. Enjoy Thanksgiving 2016. It's my pleasure to spend it with you. Sandy Rios on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The Pilgrims came to New England because it seemed to be relatively empty. They could do whatever they wanted, no one would bother them.
I see it!
America represented a fresh page and especially a clean slate. They just wanted to get out of England.
They came for freedom to create a godly city, a place where you could live a pure life, a perfect life under God's rules.
If the pilgrims had known what they were in for, they almost certainly wouldn't have done it. They were really on their own, and they had this very tenuous lifeline back to England.
It was an incredibly inhospitable environment in terms of climate. New England, of course, had very cold weather in the winter, and so it was very, very difficult for the settlers early on.
And that first year was devastating for them. They were dying of starvation, they were dying of disease.
One of the things the pilgrims discovered relatively early on was how little they knew about how to farm.
That's the first part of a special by the History Channel on Thanksgiving. And you know, I never get tired of hearing America's story, and more so now because we're not hearing it. And after all we've been through, after all we've been through this last several weeks, it's a good time to revisit it here at Thanksgiving in 2016. I can't think of anyone I would rather talk to about this. I think he has to undoubtedly be one of the nation's leading experts on the topic and manages to make it absolutely fascinating. His name is Bill Federer. He's the president of Amerisearch, which, by the way, is a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. He's also the voice and the author behind American Minute, which is a radio feature broadcast across America every day. He has a television show called Faith in History Television, which airs on TCT Network and on stations across America via DirecTV. Bill ran for Congress from Missouri a long time ago. He is very active in public affairs. He is an intellectual of the first rate. He's been on television all over. He's written several books. The first one I remember actually intersecting him on and getting to know about was America's God and Country, Encyclopedia of Quotations. I still use it. It's a great resource. And so I've asked Bill to join us this morning to tell a story that, Bill, how many times do you think you've told this story through the years?
Lots of times, and each time it gets more fascinating. But it's great to be with you, Sandy.
Are you serious? Don't you get tired of telling it?
Well, no. Matter of fact, I wrote a new book called Rise of the Tyrant and then a DVD called Who is the King in America? And I did an ambitious project. I decided I was going to research every single century of recorded human history and found out that human records appear about 3 or 4,000 BC, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley. That is the beginning of writing, which in a sense is not that long ago, right? 3 or 4,000 BC, we're around 2080. That's around 5 or 6,000 years. Think of it, 6,000 years is just 60 people living 100 years each back to back. We've all met someone who's lived 100 years, maybe a grandmother or at least close to 100. We're talking 60 grandmothers, and you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history.
Wow.
But my question was, what is the most common form of government? Well, let's see. 2,000 years, 33 major Egyptian dynasties ruled by pharaohs. Sargon, king of Akkadia. The 5,000 years, 18 major Chinese dynasties ruled by emperors. Indian Maharajas, Cyrus of Persia, Darius, Nebuchadnezzar, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Muslim sultans, Byzantine emperors, king of Spain, France, and Austria. It's kings. Lo and behold, hands down, the most common form of government is a king. You know, people say, we don't have kings anymore. Yeah, we do. We just call them communist and socialist dictators. So every communist and socialist country has a dictator. Stalin, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, Castro. I mean, Hitler was the head of the National Socialist Workers' Party. And then the Communist Party members are the new royalty. They get to live in the nice houses with special neighborhoods. And then the people are the peasants. You know, students say, I thought communism and socialism was everybody owns everything equally. Let's think a little deeper. Who decides who lives in the nice house and who lives in the dumpy house? Somebody in the government dictates those things. Well, whoever ultimately dictates those things is the dictator. And so power wants to concentrate into the hands of one person. And I think it goes back to the fall in the garden, Cain killing Abel. So you put some babies in a playpen. One of them takes the rattle from the others. Put some kids on a playground. One of them is the bully hogging the ball. Put some junior high girls in a clique, and one of them is the diva. You put some people in the woods, one of them is the Indian chief. You put some people in the inner city, one of them is a gang leader. And so this situation keeps repeating on ever larger scales, and it's a hierarchical system. In other words, if you're friends with the king, you are more equal. If you are not friends with the king, you are less equal. And if you're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason. It's like this pyramid, right? With the Pharaoh and the king at the top and his supporters and his army and then the slaves at the bottom. And so America's founders decided they didn't like the king thing. When they broke from the King of England was the most powerful king on the planet. Had 13 million square miles, a half a billion people, all of India, a quarter of the world's population right there. Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, British Guiana, countries in Africa, from Egypt down to South Africa, and America. And our founders decided to split away from a king. And we had no army, no navy, just a bunch of courageous people with faith. Anyway, zeroing in on the pilgrims. So I read through every charter of every colony. And most of them, it's the king deciding who is going to run the colony in his stead. There's three types of colonies. There's company colonies, the Virginia Company, and it had bylaws that the king approved. And then when Virginia went bankrupt, they threw it in the king's lap, and he sent over a royal crown governor that was ruling directly under the king. A third type of colony is a proprietary colony, where the king gives the whole thing to a friend. Lord Baltimore got all of Maryland as his property. William Penn got all of Pennsylvania, 45,000 square miles, as his personal property. Anyway, but it's the king deciding who's going to run it. When the pilgrims got blown off course, and they landed in Massachusetts in the winter of 1620. It was so stormy and dangerous that the captain says, we're not going to make it to Jamestown. You're going to spend the winter here. And they thought, well, we were going to submit to the Jamestown government. So we're not prepared. There's no king-appointed person on our boat. Who's going to be in charge? They do something that's revolutionary. They grant themselves the authority. And it's called the Mayflower Compact. And it says, we in the presence of God covenant ourselves together to form a civil body politic. And we agree to render all due submission to the laws we pass. This was revolutionary. This was them granting themselves permission to form a government and agreeing to submit to it. Where did they get this idea?
Hang on a second, because this is a new concept to me. I suppose I always thought that the pilgrims came here with the idea of establishing something other than a relationship with a king. So it never occurred to me. I guess it was so deeply, again, embedded in their DNA that there was, because they came from different countries, primarily England, but they all had kings who controlled them, and that's all they knew. So they didn't come here with the idea of establishing a different kind of government.
Right. They just thought that it was such a rural area, they could sort of sneak off and have their own little community in the woods, and they wouldn't be bothered. Western Europe was all Catholic, and then the Muslims invade. Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, with an army of 100,000, surrounds Vienna, Austria in 1529. Martin Luther says, the Turk is the rod of the wrath of the Lord our God. If the Turk's God, the devil is not beaten first, there is reason to fear the Turk will not be so easy to beat. Anyway, the Catholic Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V of Spain, And credit where credit's due, it was the Catholic Church that for centuries kept the Muslims from taking over Europe. But Charles V is using the gold from the New World to fit his navy to keep the Muslims from taking over the Mediterranean. Anyway, Charles V, being Catholic, is faced with a double dilemma. The Reformation started in 1517 by Martin Luther, and the Muslim invasion surrounding Vienna in 1529. And so Charles V does something unique. He does a deal with the Protestants. It's called the Peace of Augsburg of 1555. It's the first treaty ever to recognize Protestants. And in there is a little Latin phrase that had enormous repercussions. What was the phrase? Cuius regio, ius religio, which means whose is the reign, his is the religion. In other words, look, Protestant king, believe whatever you want in your kingdom. Let's just work together against these Muslims who are invading Europe because they want to kill us all. And it worked. It stopped the Muslim invasion, but it started a domino effect in the next century where different kings decided to believe different things. And so northern Germany and Sweden were Lutheran, Switzerland Calvinist, Scotland Presbyterian, Holland Dutch Reformed, Greece was Greek Orthodox, Russia was Russian Orthodox, England was Anglican, and of course Spain, Portugal, France, Austria, Italy, Poland, Ireland remained Catholic. But it was this situation that what the king believed, the kingdom had to believe. And if you did not believe the way your king did, you were persecuted and you fled. And so prior to the Muslim invasion of Europe, Western Europe was all Catholic. after the Muslim invasion and the Peace of Augsburg and different kings believing different things, it began to be where there was this mass migration of people shifting from one kingdom to another simply for conscience sake. Those were the ones that spilled over and founded colonies in America. And their attitude in America was, if you don't like our denomination, fine, start your own colony. It was one denomination per colony.
That's true. But that's true. Well, you know what? You should sit on that for a second, because I think that's a concept that's lost. And it tells us really a lot about how our founding fathers felt about separation of church and state, you know, the phrase, because each colony, one was Maryland was Baptist, Pennsylvania was, I don't know, yeah, you're right. They were, the lines were firm and they were strong, so they transferred the whole notion of sort of dictating. Did they dictate faith, you think, or did everybody in Maryland have to be a Baptist, or how did that work exactly?
No, Maryland was Catholic, Rhode Island was Baptist,
okay.
New York was Dutch Reformed, Delaware and New Jersey were Swedish Lutheran, Virginia was Anglican, Pennsylvania was Quaker, the Carolinas were officially Anglican, but they had a loophole that the Lord Proprietors could let in non-Anglicans so they could hurry up and populate the colony. Georgia was plain Protestant. Connecticut, New Hampshire were Congregationalists, and they did not get along. They would tar and feather each other, chase each other out. You know, New York, Dutch Reform would chase out the Lutherans. Virginia would chase out the Puritans. The Puritans would chase out the Quakers. And it wasn't until the Revolution started, and they all had to work together against the King of England, that they began to appreciate each other. After the Revolution, their attitude was, we may not agree on religion all the time, but you were willing to fight and die for my freedom. I need to let you practice your faith.
And
so they tolerate each other first.
And Bill, we need to say, as the obvious, sometimes things are obvious to you because you, this is, again, so a territory that you've been over so many times. That's what the meaning of the separation of church and state was. They didn't want everybody to have to be Catholic or Christian Reformed or the early Baptists, the Anabaptists, or none of those. Your particular denomination was not going to be adopted by the state, but they in no way meant that there would not be a Christian influence in America. They just assumed that. So, but you made a statement that I didn't let you finish. You said that when the pilgrims came here, they then thought they were going to go to Jamestown Colony, which was controlled by King George, but they were going to be so far away he couldn't control them. But you said they then formed their own pact, the Mayflower Compact, and we should come back to that too in a minute. And they formed their own government. You said, where did they plant that? Where did they get that idea? And I didn't let you answer your own question. Where did they get that idea?
They got it from their pastor, John Robinson. And by the way, there's a painting on our U.S. Capitol wall called The Embarkation of the Pilgrims. And it has the pilgrims on the deck of their first boat, the Speedwell, but it has John Robinson, their pastor, kneeling with his hands out, and next to him is Elder William Brewster with an open Bible. And so he was not a king-appointed pastor. You see, in England, the king was the head of the church, and all the pastors had to look to the king as their boss. You know, I mentioned how the Western European countries were Catholic. If we look at England, the king was Catholic. His name was Henry VIII. He was married to Catherine of Aragon. She was the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, the ones who sent Columbus to America. So Ferdinand and Isabella sent Columbus. They have a daughter, Catherine, married to Henry VIII of England. After 18 years, she does not have a son, so Henry decides to divorce her. The Pope won't recognize the divorce because she is, after all, the daughter of the most powerful guy in the world, the King of Spain. And so Henry VIII decides he's going to make himself his own Pope. He starts the Church of England, puts himself on as the head, and he goes on to have six wives. Their fates were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. And anyway, his advisors suggested if he really wanted to break with the Church of Rome, he should no longer use that old Latin Bible and get himself an English Bible. He thinks that's a good idea, so he spreads the English Bible around the country. But something unexpected happened. People began to read it and began to compare what's in this English Bible to this king divorcing and beheading his wives and claiming to be the head of Christ's church. And so a group started that wanted to purify the church, and they were nicknamed the Puritans. Well, the king did not think he needed purifying, so he persecuted them. He had an archbishop, William Laud, and he would arrest them, and they'd drag them into the Star Chamber, and they would torture them, and they would send spies into the churches and listen to the sermons, sort of like the mayor of Houston, and the pastors would have their nose cut in half, their ears cut off, branded on the face as a heretic with SL, seditious libel, whipped and put in the Tower of London until they died. It was a serious thing. Another group said, it's beyond hope of trying to purify the Church of England. We're going to separate ourselves. And they would meet in barns and basements by candlelight. They'd get caught and arrested. They eventually fled to Holland, and we call them the Pilgrims. They're in Holland for 12 years until Spain threatens to attack Holland, and they're going to go. Originally, they were planning on going to Guyana in South America. They heard of the perpetual spring, and but then they heard of the malaria and the Indian attacks, and then the Spanish Main.
And then they got the perpetual winter instead. Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
Bill,
hurricanes. And
so fascinating. And but we have to take a break. And when we come back, let's pick it up from the Mayflower Compact. And if we have to track that first Thanksgiving for sure. If we say nothing else, we have to do that because this is Thanksgiving of 2016, a time to be grateful for all that God has done. You can see in the hand of history how he turned what might have been bad things to good and used them for his purposes. It's a story, it's a great story. And personally, I never get tired of it. And I never get tired of hearing it from Bill Federer. We'll take a break and be right back. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
They discovered that the Indians were farmers too. And because relations between the Pilgrims and the Indians were relatively good at the beginning, there was an exchange of technology.
And the Native Americans really helped them, and you have this period of cooperation between the two groups.
They learn that what you have to do is put the seed in the ground, but if you put a fish head along with that, it will grow much better.
It must have been a strange and curious and wonderful thing to see people using fish meal to make the soil more productive and things grow faster and more abundantly.
It is not just a one-way trade, there will also be the other way of new European crops coming into the New World.
But if it weren't for the Native American communities, the Pilgrims would have been wiped out.
The success of the Pilgrims and their descendants was beyond their imagination. And the country that emerged from this is one of the most successful in world history. So it's not at all surprising that Americans have this belief that America is exceptional.
Wow, that's just a clip from the History Channel's special on the Pilgrims, which is just powerful. I don't know if all of it's accurate, but I think what we just heard is pretty accurate. I'm talking with Bill Federer on this Thanksgiving of 2016, and we are recounting this most fabulous story. And you know, Bill, I find when I have traveled the world that people from other parts of this very big world know our history better than our own people. We are, you know, even the parents of the current generation were not taught history like this. So I think we're providing an important service. Certainly you are. By the way, Bill is the voice and the author of American Minute, which is featured daily across America on radio. Also his television program, His Faith in History. He's written tons of books. The most recent are Rise of the Tyrant and Who is the King in America. That's a DVD that's offered. Is it America? What's the website in case they want to order these things, Bill?
Oh, thank you. It's AmericanMinute.com.
Okay, AmericanMinute.com. We'll put that, by the way, on our Facebook page so that you can reference it. All right, Bill, so these pilgrims that we've already described who were persecuted by King George make their way.
King James.
Oh, King James.
Correct.
Yes. Thank you for correcting me. King James, they make their way. It's a very dramatic story how they make their way across the ocean. Some people may at least know that. In the three boats, they thought they were going to land at Jamestown, but instead they landed in this Plymouth Rock, this wretched place, at least for weather. And they form, as Bill just told us, the Mayflower Compact. And before we move beyond that, Bill, just help us to understand how deeply Christian that document was.
Right. So the little background, the Muslims are taking over the Mediterranean, and Spain has its navy defeat the Muslims at the Battle of Lepanto in 1571. And then, rather than freeing the rest of the Mediterranean up from the Muslims, Spain takes its armada and decides to squash the Reformation in England. But the Spanish armada hit a hurricane and was destroyed. And when that happened, the other European countries said, hey, Spain's not as tough as we thought. They had a monopoly on the New World for a century. The other European country says, hey, some Oklahoma land rush, and you had them hurry up. New Amsterdam was founded by the Dutch. New Sweden was founded by the Swedes, and that ended up turning into Delaware and New Jersey. You had New England, but it was this hurry up and stake the claim in the New World. And so the English had Virginia, the Virginia Company, and then the Pilgrims were going to land there. They got blown off course and landed in Massachusetts. Now, this is where the unique experiment takes place. The whole world is kings and emperors and, dictators. And in New England, you had churches that started communities. So the Pilgrims land, and they have a successful colony from 620 to 630. Back in England, the Puritans are getting persecuted more and more and more until finally they decide to flee. In 1630, there's a great migration. Tens of thousands of Puritans leave England and they settle Massachusetts. Well, something happens. In England, the Puritans did not like the king telling them how to have church. In Massachusetts, the Puritans said, you know what? We are here in such large numbers. We sort of are the government. Maybe it's not such a bad thing that we tell the church how to have church. And so some of these other pastors decide, wait a second, we're still not supposed to have the government tell how to. So John Lothrop is a pastor. He and his church flee from the Puritans and settle Barnstable, Massachusetts. There's a Reverend Roger Williams, right? He's a pastor, and he flees with a church, and they found Providence, Rhode Island, and the First Baptist Church in America. He would write pamphlets that would say, if the king can stand there on the day of judgment and answer for your conscience, fine, believe whatever the king tells you. If the king can't be there on the day of judgment, you're accountable to God for your own conscience. Right, so he has to flee. England comes to Massachusetts, and then when they're telling him, oh, we're going to tell you how to have church, he goes, no, you're not supposed to. Well, they persecute him. He flees in Providence, Rhode Island. A Reverend John Wheelwright and his church found Exeter, New Hampshire, and a Reverend Thomas Hooker and his church found Hartford, Connecticut. And so this is 50 years before Europe's Age of Enlightenment and John Locke's writing his two treatises on government. And this Reverend Thomas Hooker and his church flee. And they found Hartford, Connecticut. And then the people of his church go to him and they say, Pastor, how do we do the government thing? And so he gives a sermon in 1638. And he says, the foundation of authority is laid firstly in the free consent of the people. This is revolutionary because the whole rest of the world, the foundation of authority is this divine right of the kings, that God gives the power to the king and he dispenses it to those underneath of him. And this is, no. The creator gives the rights directly to the people and they collectively vote their peers into leadership. It's a bottom-up form of government. His sermon is written down. It's considered the first written constitution in history. It's called the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut. It's used in Connecticut from 1639 up until 1818. There's actually a statue at the Hartford Capitol of Reverend Thomas Hooker holding a Bible. And at the bottom of the statue, it talks about him preaching the famous sermon, which gave birth to the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut. There's actually a plaque in England that says, Thomas Hooker, Puritan clergyman, reputed father of American democracy. People don't realize that there is a congregational pastor named Thomas Hooker who's considered the father of American democracy. Well, where did he get the ideas? Well, the same thing from the Pilgrims. So you read his Fundamental Orders. It says, where a people are gathered together, the word of God requires that to maintain peace, there should be an orderly and decent government established according to God, and then the people can join ourselves together to be as one public state or commonwealth. Wait a second, that sounds very similar to the Pilgrims, right? That we come together to form a civil body politic. And so we're beginning to see in America the development of a bottom-up form of government of the people ruling themselves rather than a top-down form of government of some king sending over his representative that's going to rule in the king's stead. And so that was the brilliance of America, and it unleashed human potential. So you're free to do stuff and keep the benefits of what you do. In totalitarian governments, whether it's a king or it's a communism, you come up with an invention, it's owned by the government. And so guess what? You're not motivated to stay up all night in your garage and work on something new because it'll be taken away from you. Well, in America, without a king, you get to benefit from your creativeness, your hard work, your education, and it unleashes this human creativity and potential. And so all these different inventions, you know, people say, well, you know, we have this unique form of government. It's democratically elected constitutional republic. It takes years. It's like a genetically engineered seed. And it took thousands of years for it. But wait a second. What do you do with the seed? You plant it in soil. Well, this seed was planted in a soil that was 98% Protestant, a little less than a 1% Catholic, and a tenth of a percent Jewish. And it produced this harvest of freedom and opportunity and creativity and prosperity. We take the same seed and we plant it over in Muslim countries. And we get rid of Saddam Hussein. We introduce a constitutional government. In one election, it's taken over by the fundamentalist Muslims who put in place the death penalty. If you leave Islam, and women can be beaten and polygamy. It's like, and we scratch our heads thinking, what happened to the seed? It didn't work. No, you just planted in a Muslim soil. You know, the Soviet Union fell apart. We go over there and help them set up republics and democracies. And then it gets taken over by the mafia, organized crime, right? And we scratch our heads. Why didn't this seed work? Well, you just planted it in a soil that had 70 years of atheism plowed in it. Atheism says this life is all there is. Do whatever you can to get ahead. So we have to realize there were two things that made America great. One is this seed of a brilliant, genetically engineered, democratically elected constitutional republic, but it was planted in a soil that was 3 million people, 98% were Protestant. I read through every state constitution. 9 of the original 13 state constitutions required you to be a Protestant Catholic, I mean, Protestant Christian to hold office. Catholics were only allowed in 3 colonies, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New York. And you can read right through these constitutions. I mean, in 1778, you have South Carolina's state constitution, and it says the Christian Protestant religion shall be deemed the established religion of this state. I think they established it. It says so. John Adams wrote Massachusetts's 1780 constitution. It says every office holder shall declare, I believe, the Christian religion. The legislature shall support public Protestant teachers of piety and religion. That was 1780. Georgia's 1777 constitution says representatives shall be chosen out of the residents of each county. They shall be of the Protestant religion. New Jersey's 1776 constitution, all persons professing a belief in the faith of any Protestant sect shall be capable of holding office.
Bill, let me interrupt.
1784.
Yeah, let me interrupt you because, I mean, that's great. I mean, that's really interesting to hear that. It reminds me of the claims that Barack Obama has made as president that Muslims go back to the very beginnings of America and our history and our foundings. Is there any evidence of that?
Columbus would have never set sail if the Muslims had not conquered Constantinople in 1453, cutting off the land routes. And that's what gave Columbus the idea to go to a sea route to India and China. So we would not, and then the whole Reformation started because when the Muslims were conquering Greece and destroying their churches and their libraries, the Greek scholars fled to Western Europe with their Greek New Testaments. And so this is what caused scholars like Erasmus to begin to translate the Bible all the way back to Greek, and this laid the foundation for the Reformation. And the Muslims enslaved Africans and would force them to convert to Islam. And so Muslims enslaved 180 million Africans, would castrate the men, make them eunuchs, sell them into the sex trafficking. And so the Spaniards discovered the New World, and there were some greedy guys that enslaved Native Americans for about 50 years. And then the same time Martin Luther's doing the Reformation, there's a Catholic priest named Bartolomé de las Casas, and he spends his whole life to get the King of Spain to stop enslaving Native Americans. He's finally successful. And then the greedy guys say, where can we get more slaves if we can't enslave Native Americans? And someone said, Africa. And so they began the slave trade. So every slave brought to America from Africa was purchased at a Muslim slave market. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these slaves were forced to convert to Islam or they would kill them. And so they would bring them to the New World. And so, you can say that there were some Muslims here, but Islam was not one where people voluntarily converted. They had to convert or die. So you really can't consider them as converts in our frame of reference.
Bill, we just have 1 minute left, just about a little bit over a minute. Is there any, in all of your readings and all of your study, is there any country whose history compares in any way to the rich history of the foundings of this country?
Yeah, ancient Israel. So when our Constitution was written, it needed to be ratified. And so needed nine states. New Hampshire was the ninth, but it was in a deadlock at its ratifying convention. So Harvard President Samuel Langdon gives an address. The Republic of the Israelites, an example to the American states. Instead of the 12 tribes of Israel, we may substitute the 13 states of the American Union and see this. And so ancient Israel, when they come out of Egypt into the Promised Land, those first 400 years, there was no king. Everyone was equal before the law. This is the beginning of the concept of equality. Ancient Israel had private land ownership. Right, where there's a king, you never really own the land. It's always conditional, you staying on the nice side of the king. In Israel, the land was permanently titled to the families. Ancient Israel had no standing army. You have a king, he has an army to enforce his will. In Israel, every yes. man was in the militia and armed and ready at a moment's notice to defend his community.
So the similarities are unbelievable. But besides that, I mean, this is a unique history that we can see the hand of God in almost at every turn. Bill, we're out of time. You and I could talk for hours, and we should. And by the way, if you want to hear more of Bill, AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. His most recent book, Arise of the Tyrant, his DVD, Who is the King in America? Bill, happy Thanksgiving 2016, and thank you for all that you have given in terms of information to help us understand the uniqueness of this country. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Sandy.
Sandy Rios in the morning. Happy Thanksgiving.